the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
As the fight over a pay deal heats up, staff at one major pillar of Victoria's fire protection are preparing to do less work, particularly on planned burns and fire preparation. Is that okay? You're going to hear about Forest Fire Management's staff plans soon as they continue to fight for more pay. Does things like planned burns, should that be allowed as part of industrial action? We will talk about that. You can give me your view. Send a text 0467 842 722. And virtual fencing is here. The rules are in place now. Virtual fencing is allowed in Victoria. If you do not know what that means, it means drawing lines on your computer as to where the fence can be and collars, which can deliver a shock, as well as audio cues to animals, tell them where they can and can't walk. The Agriculture Minister will tell you the plan for virtual fencing shortly. And if you were listening yesterday on the Country Hour, you heard some pretty tough concerns about the PALM scheme and the workers in it having terrible experiences and thousands being disengaged. So what can be done? Even if you've missed that, listen today. You'll find some interesting solutions pitched in terms of if we're going to have work schemes that allow Pacific Island workers to come here and work and they're treated poorly, how do you make that system better? We'll talk about that today and a whole lot more. You can give me a call 1300 977 222 or send a text 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Yeah, Forest Fire Management Victoria staff are taking steps which could mean fewer planned burns next year as part of the battle over pay and conditions. The agency which responds to bushfires in public land particularly conducts planned burns and manages fuel loads in state forests and national parks have been taking protected industrial action over stalled negotiations for more than a year. Australian Workers Union organiser James Newbold, who represents FFMV staff, outlines the key issues for staff in this enterprise agreement dispute and what could be on the table in terms of action.
The biggest issue for our members is the fact that they are not paid enough for what they do. If you did the same job working at Parks Victoria, you'd get paid roughly somewhere between 7% and 14% more, depending on your level within the organisation. So this is something that we are fighting to fix, and we're confident that we'll win.
And I understand another thing is for the members and the staff to be recognised as firefighters. What's that about?
That's right. So our members feel they're not really recognised as the emergency workers that they are. It's only when it's convenient for an emergency response or for the government that they're treated as emergency workers. But on their day-to-day, they're treated as land managers, and that's something that they're proud of and that they also do. But we've had to fight over the years to have them added into the presumptive cancer legislation that's been put in place for emergency workers, the additional superannuation entitlements that have been put in place for emergency workers. And it's all patchwork when we just want our members to feel like they're recognised as the emergency workers that they do. They respond to fires, floods, storms, even beachings and things like that. I think our members feel like it's a double standard when they're asked to do emergency work, and our members are happy to do the emergency work. They actually look forward to it because they get paid more and their base wage isn't enough to pay the bills. So they do it really tough over the winter when there's less of it to do. They're happy to do the emergency work, but they just feel it's a double standard. It feels like they're being taken advantage of.
Staff from FFMV, as you say, have been taking protected action for more than 12 months. That's when the Fair Work Commission gives permission to union and their members to take certain actions so that they can try and force an outcome, I guess, from, in this case, the state government. What kind of actions are you doing at the moment, and what kind of impact would be people out in the regions, what would they be seeing?
There's dozens of different actions our members are taking every single day, day after day. But to give you a bit of a taste of some of the big ones, if listeners have seen a shortage of firewood in the firewood coops, that's because our members have put in place bans on the felling and handling of firewood. We also have our members taking lunch in their work centre. Usually they would have to take it out in the field in, you know, improper lunch facilities in the middle of state forests and things like that. they're all heading back to their work centres or other locations they deem appropriate for lunch. At the moment, there's a ban on the operation of vehicles every afternoon as well. Now, just to reassure the listeners, we have carve-outs on these actions so that when an emergency event comes up and our members would be paid an emergency allowance to attend, our members do go and attend that event. As much as it might, you know, hurt their chances of forcing an outcome, looking after the community, looking after the environment is the reason our members stay in the job despite the pay.
Now, you're currently balloting again, and that's to do more actions. And some of that will involve planned burns preparation, which is one of the major things that the staff do out in the bush. What does that involve, and what would that mean if that ballot got through?
There's over 30 different questions on the new ballot. It's our third protected action ballot. Some of the questions involve bans on the use of chainsaws, bans on the use of rake hose, which are, you could maybe say, two of the most important tools in a forest firefighter's toolkit. We're also looking at potentially voting on bans on the performance of work under the Joint Fuel Management Plan, which is that plan put out every year by DECA and the CFA together that says, here's all the burn preparation we're going to do and the burns we're going to undertake over the next few years. That could be impacted. Bans on work other than emergency work, and bans on a whole range of different tools and equipment and different tasks our members will have the option to take if they vote yes to the actions as they have in the past.
Regional communities would be very concerned if any of this meant a slowdown on planned burns in the regions, just because there is a big fuel load, they are concerned about fires. So are members thinking about this?
Yeah, our members are very reasonable about these things, and we do take precautions with this sort of stuff. In fact, interstate this year already, three forest firefighters and their support workers have been killed on the job, and we're only 9 days, as we record this interview, into summer. So this is something at the forefront of our members' minds. It's about their safety as well. So they do all this wanting to get the best outcome for everybody.
Some of what you're asking is that you want to get paid more. That's obviously going to have an impact on the bottom line for the budget and for taxpayers. Does that weigh on their mind at all when they're thinking about what they want out of an ABA?
Yeah, so our members, you know, they're country people. They deal with all the same issues as other country people. And it's front of mind for them. What we hope is that when they make a decent income, they're going to inject that straight back into their communities in the regions. They're a big workforce, over 1,000 across the state, including a big seasonal component. It's a real benefit to Victoria, I think, that these people do, and it's something that I'm personally happy for my tax dollars to go towards. But in addition to all of that, our members had actually agreed through this process to a bunch of compromises or offsets to help cover the costs of this sort of thing, and that's meant some potential reductions in other conditions of theirs. Now, that's all up in the air at the moment. We are, you know, just trying everything we can to get this over the line and offering all sorts of compromises left, right and centre because we want this deal done. So we're trying to be reasonable on our end. We just think that if they're already paying some workers in Victoria this amount, it's not really fair to pay others less.
That's Australian Workers Union organiser James Newbold speaking there to Emma Field. We did contact the government about this and they have sent through some lines in the last hour or so. Let's pull them up for you. This is from a DECA spokesperson, so the department that looks after FFMV staff, Forest Fire Management Victoria staff, saying, "We respect the right of employees to undertake protected industrial action in line with the Fair Work Act 2009. DECA is actively bargaining with the AWU and seeking a resolution. Staff are undertaking industrial action in a way that doesn't compromise emergency response work or firefighter safety," end quote. Although part of that industrial action will involve doing fewer planned burns next year. That does affect fire management in Victoria, doesn't it? That does affect safety of communities, doesn't it? How do you feel about that? 1300 977 222 or text 0467 842 722. Not a lot of commentary in terms of that particular part of management of fires, but a couple of texts coming in all the same saying, "This guy's representative of the Department of Complaints and Whinging." That's the union, not the department speaking there, but I certainly take your comment. Marty says, "Given the abysmal effort of forest fire management during the Little Desert fires in January, if they don't turn up, they won't be missed." They used to assist in controlling fires when it left the park into private property. Regards Marty, certainly on that specific issue of fires. And I know there's a lot of anger out in that community about how the Little Desert Fire was managed. Marty giving voice to that there.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
Let's talk about something else right now on the Country Hour. That's virtual fencing. The rules to allow virtual fencing are now here, but it might be a little while until you see cattle in fenceless paddocks. Virtual fencing is when animals wear collars and with audio cues and eventually a shock, they're told where they can and can't go on a property. In dairy, it's used a lot for strip grazing. It's used a lot in beef operations for pasture management as well. And has many more different applications in various other states and internationally in areas like New Zealand. But approval needed to be gained here before it was allowed. That process has happened throughout this year, but more approvals are still needed before it makes its way to farms. Victorian Agriculture Minister Ros Spence can actually tell you more about where we're up to in this. Ros Spence, welcome back to the Country.
Thanks for having me, Warwick.
Another major step in virtual fencing becoming a reality for Victorian farmers. What's being announced today?
Yeah, it's great news, Warwick. So the regulations that will allow virtual fencing in Victoria come into effect as of today, and that means that manufacturers can now apply to Agriculture Victoria to have their virtual fencing technology approved. We expect that, though, the approvals will come through in February, and then farmers will be able to adopt this technology for virtual fencing and herding on their farms.
Yeah, so literally the rule change is, as of today, it's allowed, yep. But you have to go through a process, and the first approvals will be done by February, it's expected. Is that right?
That's right. It's the manufacturers that have to go through their approvals, and that's to ensure that, you know, that there's safeguards to ensure that there's animal welfare, but also allowing this innovation. So the standards of what needs to be approved are all set out in the regulations. Manufacturers will go through that, and then when farmers, if they choose to adopt the technology, they know what they're getting is safe and good, and they'll have some requirements that they still need to adhere to. But yes, it's the manufacturer approval first.
And what are some of the safeguards that you have in place to make sure this technology is really for farming rather than, you know, any adverse effects to the animal?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot. I won't go through all of them, but there's issues like making sure that they're not used on animals under 6 months of age, that animals are introduced and trained to the system by a competent trainer or in accordance with the manufacturer's training program, that they be trained to use a system by someone who is undertaking the manufacturer's training program. So it all has to be linked together. They've got to ensure that the virtual boundaries don't prevent reasonable access to food, water or shelter. They need to ensure that there is still a permanent boundary. I guess another important one is that they need to still regularly check the health and welfare of animals which are on the system. And that's important to note because there are a number of health and well-being issues that can be assisted by the technology, such as identifying if an animal is potentially lame, not ruminating as much as the other animals in the herd. So you can identify that, but you shouldn't solely rely on the technology for that.
So you don't want these rules to replace any animal husbandry and prevention of cruelty to animal rules that you already have in place too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And where do you see this technology? Where is the industry telling you where this technology is going to be in use? Is it a dairy setting or is it beyond that as well?
It can be dairy or beef. So the demonstration down at Allen Bank that went on from July last year to May this year, that was looking at dairy. After going and visiting Allen Bank, I went over to Tasmania and saw a couple of farms where they were using the technology, not in a trial setting, but as business as usual. And they had adopted, I visited where it was being used on dairy and also beef cattle. So it has that diversity, but it was interesting talking to different people about how they saw it. So meeting with young farmers who were quite excited about this technology and how it changed what traditional dairy farming was and gave them back some hours in their life, frankly. So that they were quite excited. One in particular had said that he'd come back to farming because this technology excited him so much. Speaking to older couple who were able to extend their working lives because the labour involved in running fences was no longer required. So they loved their work, but they were starting to get to the point where the labour involved was a bit too intense, and this has relieved them of a lot of that labour. But then also talking to people who are excited and interested in the technology, but it's not something that they think they'll adopt.
These rules require record keeping and reporting. Is that onus on the farmer or the manufacturer?
Well, there'll need to be both, frankly. So you need to keep a record of what you're doing, and there is requirements for the manufacturers to keep a record of where they have the fencing and, you know, who's using it. So they're not onerous requirements. I think that's important to note. And talking to other jurisdictions, they don't see this to be a burden.
This change, these new regulations come in under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act 1986. The government's been doing some work alongside this to update that act as well. Where is that work at, and will these law changes be reflected in any future changes to the Cruelty to Animals Act?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Any changes that we've made now, people should have an expectation that any legislative changes in the future would still enable what is allowed now. So that should be, people should be comfortable about that. Where are we at with that? Well, there is still ongoing stakeholder consultation. We have had a very busy legislative year, but that work is still underway.
And it is now less than a year to the election, as I'd imagine you've probably been reminded at already a number of times. This is obviously a key part of your time as Agriculture Minister in Victoria. Is there much else that you still want to get done in this year run up to the election? Are there major items that you're still working on?
There are, but there's also the important ongoing work that we've always got to have an eye to, and that in particular all biosecurity matters, preparedness for avian influenza should H5 arrive. So there's a lot of important work that we have to keep doing and keep monitoring and make sure that we keep our state safe.
Well, Minister, it's been good to talk to you again. I won't be speaking to you on this program before Christmas, so have a Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you again in the new year.
Same to you. Thanks, Warwick, and thanks for all your work during the year.
Agriculture Minister Ros Spence speaking to you there, and that. Right, I've only got one country out to do after this one, because tomorrow Faith Tabalion's got a special program from you from Warragul, which is, you know, farming on the edge when it comes to Melbourne these days. So how that's changing and how farmers are there and what are farmers going through there, plus plenty of season chat from a really up and down year in that area of West Gippsland too. That will be tomorrow's country hour. Then Friday, I'll finish up for the year. I've got a couple of weeks to do in Melbourne, then have a holiday as well. So if you do love your Melbourne breakfast programs, I'll pop up there. Otherwise, keep listening to your local one. I bet that's pretty good too. Chris on the text says, we've been dealing with a lack of controlled burns for years. More and more land being locked up with less management at the moment. The consequence is more fires. Dave sent a text to say he's having local TV reception issues. David, I've had similar lately. Can't say I can help you on that though, Dave. Thanks for your text though. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text. Now, look, on the country here, we brought you really interesting story. You can go back and listen to it if you want in yesterday's podcast when you have the time. You don't need to do it before this one, but it was a great bit of journalism to look at what's happening for some in the PALM scheme, where people are falling through the cracks and becoming disengaged. Thousands of workers becoming disengaged, leaving their employers and becoming vulnerable whilst in Australia in visa limbo. It's affecting thousands. So what can be done about it? As Lucy Cooper reports, it's all about implementing change from the ground up, and she's been looking at how that can be done.
Towns across regional and rural Australia are grappling with disengaged workers, labourers who have left companies they were recruited to work for under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM scheme. their visas are tied to their employer. So if they leave their job, their visas can be revoked. Since 2019, more than 7,000 workers have disengaged from the scheme. Many remain in Australia on bridging visas or are undocumented.
The government has largely left these workers, these people who've left the PALM scheme, who are in these really vulnerable and precarious situations. The government's completely ignored it.
Kaya Barry, an academic with Griffith University, recently co-authored a report looking into their situation.
We know that there's thousands of people out there who need support, but you know, once they're formally exited from the PALM scheme visa, it's like everybody turns a blind eye.
But there is one town wanting to change this.
You might see as you drive in, we have a sign, don't we, saying we welcome immigrants and refugees and new settlers. So they know we've got open arms.
That's George Weston. He's the mayor of Leeton Shire Council.
We've got a great heart. We have a multiculturalism organisation who go out of the way. They take them to the hospital. They look after them. They help them with filling out forms at the local, our local library to try and get their visas organised, try and give as much information as possible.
Home to about 9,000 people, Leeton is about 6 hours from Sydney. It's located in the Riverina region, known as the Food Bowl of New South Wales, a crucial agricultural region putting food on the plates of millions of Australians.
You know, we can help them. We can look after them. We can use them. And Australia can use them as well.
Leeton Shire Council is a founding member of the Mayoral Alliance for the Pacific, which aims for better outcomes for PALM scheme workers and the communities they work in.
We're trying to lobby the federal government. There's DFAT and Dwyer and Home Affairs, because they're all just different silos, and we're trying to get them together and say, hey, we've got a problem here. These people are worthy people, or they've been disengaged, but how about we get them back into the workplace, you know? Can you reevaluate and look at this?
Most of the disengaged workers in Leeton have moved there through word of mouth. Seeking connection and support, Leeton welcomes them with open arms.
It makes me really proud of Leeton, the welcoming that we do. Every individual here go out the way to help people. It makes me feel really great.
And it's not just the council which is pushing for better outcomes for disengaged workers.
We get the fallout from the PALM scheme from other locations where they come to Leeton. I will give my 100% support to PALM. But I can't support something where I see the failings that I believe we can address.
Paul Matem was the mayor of Leeton for 16 years and now leads the town's multicultural support group. He's long advocated for greater support for workers under the PALM scheme who feel they have no choice but to leave.
They've said they're too frightened to speak out because they're worried that they'll be sent back home, and in some cases been told that they will go home. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home. So if we can make it work, we can find a pathway, and we need to give them confidence that they can sit down and talk to not only people like myself, but others that we're connected to within Home Affairs and others to say, let's find a way.
He started briefing the new workers who come to Leeton under the PALM scheme. He hopes these meet and greets where he chats with them about the local sport teams and where to seek help if they're struggling will keep more workers in the scheme and reduce disengagement.
I'm just an ordinary guy, and I just feel that you know, you can sit down and talk to these people, smile with them, help them along the way as much as you can. And I think they have that trust then. And when they have trust, they don't have fear. And if they got fear, well, obviously things don't work as we'd love to see them work.
At JBS Riverina, a beef feedlot, farm and processing facility, PALM scheme workers are a crucial part of the workforce. Inorke Knox, Colony Singer, works at JBS as the PALM Support and Engagement Officer.
We believe in the workers' welfare being paramount and very important to our production as well. If the workers are looked after well outside of work, it will show on the numbers at work as well.
From Fiji and Samoa, Knox said his background helps him understand the workers better.
I know their backgrounds because I was from there and I live here as well. So if there's anyone that could help integrate them into the Australian community, there would be someone like me, someone who lives in both worlds.
Paul Matem hopes these roles and ideas which Leeton is trying to implement will become a model for the rest of the country.
We should never, ever, ever have that a person is fearful for their job.
Report author Kaya Barry is calling on the federal government to implement reforms to keep workers in the scheme.
This has already stretched on for years for some of these people who are just off the grid, really vulnerable in pretty horrific conditions most of the time.
A key one is mobility, allowing for workers to easily change employers in the scheme.
Mobility is the operative word. I mean, and to be mobile, you need to be able to move from one employer down the road to the next employer. If those amendments were made to the PALM scheme by the government, then that would be something which could be looked upon, I think, quite favourably.
That's Michael Pyers. He's the General Manager of Workplace Relations and Legal Affairs with the National Farmers Federation. He said it would be timely if a review into the operations of and lack of pay transparency associated with labour hire companies were to occur.
If you do nothing and if you just leave it as it is now that your visa is tied to this particular farm, then if the palm worker is unhappy, they will disengage. They will take matters into their own hands anyway.
The chance to easily move between employers is also endorsed by the workers themselves. Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands said he would never have left the PALM scheme if he just had the opportunity to change jobs.
If I can go back to the PALM scheme, no problem. Yeah. So I enjoy the work. I want to just earn money to support my family. But the problem is that one. Yeah, there is no transparency at all when they doing the pay and all these things.
That is Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands, ending that report from Lucy Cooper for one of the ABC programs looking at the Pacific called Pacific Beat, speaking to you there. You're listening to the Country Hour. We'll talk to contractors and hear about a pretty big birthday on the show soon. But right now, let's get some rural news with Emma Field. Hi, Emma.
G'day, Warwick. Mystery still surrounds a grass fire that started on one of Australia's largest solar farms. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service said the blaze broke out inside the Wellington North 425 megawatt solar farm in the central west of the state on Saturday afternoon and burnt more than 92 hectares. Emily Middleton reports.
3 days on from the grass fire at the Wellington North solar farm, it's still unclear as to how the fire started, according to both the RFS and the solar farm's owner. In a statement, the solar farm's owner, Lightsource BP, said damage was limited to the northeast corner of the site, and the impact on electricity output was unclear. They said that at this stage, no damage is expected to major equipment. The site is currently operating at around 90% capacity and is expected to be fully operational shortly. No further information is available on the impact of the fire at this time.
Dr. Simon Wright is a senior fellow, research fellow in renewable energy at Charles Sturt University. He says the risk from fire damage to renewable projects is similar to other infrastructure across the landscape.
My understanding of the bushfire at the weekend was it was started by a grass fire. That is a constant danger in these warm and windy conditions, and any industrial facility, any asset would potentially be exposed, and the solar farm in that regard is no different to any other industrial facility. You know, the research suggests that that solar farms pose no increased risk in the short to medium term as temperatures rise compared to any other industrial facility.
A court has heard activists are continuing to break into a northern Victorian piggery where an alleged bestiality incident occurred. Jane Neild reports.
Bradley O'Reilly is charged with committing a sexual act on a pig at Midland Bacon's Currig Currig facility and appeared before the Bendigo Magistrates Court yesterday. The court heard arguments on whether or not the footage of the alleged act, which animal activists recorded, should be admitted as evidence. The activists broke into the piggery site last year and installed secret cameras and then passed the footage on to the police. Piggery owner Rick O'Reilly gave evidence during the hearing that activists have allegedly continued to break into the piggery as recently as last week. The matter will be heard again later this month.
The timing of the national social media ban for children under aged 16, which started today, has seen boarding schools scrambling for ways to help their students navigate being cut off from their friends over the school holidays. The ban becomes law right as 76% of Australia's 21,000 boarders head back to their regional and remote homes. More than half of those are in year 10 and below and are expected to be cut off from social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram. The Australian Boarding Schools Association Chief Executive Officer, Richard Stokes, says there were concerns some rural students could be feeling even more isolated.
Now, the thing that I'm really worried about, I think the timing hasn't been thought of well. Because the 10th of December is when kids are going home from school. You know, they're on holidays, they're away from, you know, all of those support networks. So all of those borders don't have that wonderful support and circle of care around them that they would have normally during term time. So they're going to be, you know, not only away from that, but then also away from all of their friends. So they can't even talk to them. You know, they'll have to find ways to do it. So we're a bit worried about that whole mental health issue in that space.
Researchers from the University of Adelaide have described the most complete cattle genome, which should help to improve Wagyu breeding and beef marbling. Senior author of the study, Dr. Lloyd Lowe, who is a senior bioinformatician with the University of Adelaide. He says the updated Wagyu genome provides a much more complete and accurate view of the genetic blueprint behind one of the world's most prized beef breed.
There is practical benefits in terms of selecting the animals genetically, because before we didn't have a complete map, so we were mainly using one class of genetic variant known as single nucleotide polymorphisms. There is actually a lot more genetic variation in cattle that have been less studied. So with a more complete map, we can tap into a new class of genetic variants known as structural variants. So this will lead to better markers for selecting them for practical application. But it's also for biology, like understanding the biology of the species as well.
Fascinating stuff. And that wraps up Rural News.
Thanks very much for that, Emma Field, there with Rural News for you today. On the text line, Jeff at Jam Jerup says, what a waste of money and time is it having each state going to evaluate and create legislation for virtual fencing? It's not some scary new technology. I've started to do regenerative farming and had to purchase electric fencing to do strip grazing and should have spent that money on virtual fencing, says Jeff. Jeff, thanks very much for your thoughts coming in. Keep them coming. 0467 842 722. Daniel Sherwin-Simpson is the Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, ready to have a chat to you today. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Warwick.
How's it looking around Victoria this lunchtime?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a cloudy day across most of the state. We're seeing a decent amount of mid to high level clouds streaming over at the moment. Unfortunately, there isn't much in the way of showers in it. There's probably a few spots that we can expect to see over sort of the divide today, but if you're in sort of the far north or the far south of the state, probably not expecting to see much. If you do see anything today, it's probably only going to be a millimetre or two anyway. Generally, with that cloud across large parts of the state, we're looking at temperatures below average. However, we are going to start warming up over the next couple of days. We'll start to see temperatures building in the far west on Thursday. But as we get into Friday, we're expecting above average temperatures pretty much across the entire state. And those will linger around in the north onto the weekend before we sort of get a cool blast coming through. That cool blast will be due to a trough that moves over the state, mainly through Saturday, that could bring showers to large parts of the state. We're expecting the higher rainfall totals to be in the eastern districts, particularly over your Gippsland areas as well. Could be seeing some thunderstorms with that change, but thunderstorms are a risk out in the east, particularly the northeastern district, from Thursday all the way through to Saturday. So it could definitely get a bit stormy and a bit interesting out there, Warwick.
And as far as that Saturday goes, how's that rainfall moving? I'm thinking a lot of state Saturday sports played around the place, cricket matches and tennis matches alike. How's that going to move across the state, and will it be around, or is it going to be short bursts of rainfall?
Yeah, so look, we're probably expecting to start to see showers developing in the early morning or even the late evening of Friday in the west of the state, and that'll move to more central districts through the late morning, early afternoon. By the time we get into the late afternoon, things will start to clear in the eastern districts. Probably by midnight, you'll be mostly clear skies and a fine evening. So it's definitely going to traverse across the state, and we'll probably only see rainfall for a couple of hours for each period. It's not going to be the sort of thing that'll hang around all day.
Ooh, it'll be interesting for me at Tatura, Daniel, but it's not all about me. How's it looking early next week then? What are we seeing there? Does it warm back up?
Yeah, well, early next week, it does stay cool behind that trough that we're seeing move over the state, but we are expecting some warmer temperatures to develop into the mid parts of next week. When you see the Wednesday forecast come out at the end of the day, you'll expect to see above average temperatures across the state. That's going to continue into Thursday is what we're currently expecting. So there's certainly some warmth on the way in the later parts of next week.
And weather warnings-wise for the next 24 hours or so, are we looking at anything there?
Yeah, no, we're actually all clear on the board in terms of weather warnings. Very settled weather at the moment, so no warnings out currently for Victoria. The only thing that will probably be something you might need to watch out for is any thunderstorm warnings out in the eastern districts from Friday into Saturday.
2 days in a row of no warnings. I don't know what to do with myself. Daniel, thanks very much for the update.
Cheers. Thanks, Warwick.
Daniel Sherwin-Simpson there speaking to you about the weather forecast. 0467 842 722 is the text line. Joe the dairy farmer says, hi, Warwick. There's a lot being said about the new bombs web. Oh, he says app, but it was the website that we've been talking a lot about, Joe. But I get what you mean, and I can see where you're going with this. A lot said about the bombs new website. Has anything been said about the new Goulburn Murray Water, GMW Water app? It's terrible, says Joe. Are we going back there, Joe? Does anyone have a line of sight on this? Is it something that is raising concerns, or is Joe just not loving the upgrade? You can let me know, 0467 842 722. We've had a lot of website chat this year on the country. I'm happy to continue to do it, though, if things aren't hitting the mark. And Bo on the Palm Scheme says, Palm Scheme workers are no different to itinerant workers that have been here for years. We need more protection for them. Yes, some of them have been working here illegally, but that does not mean they're any less important. This also includes all legal work visa people. Our Palm Scheme workers are happy as Larry. $4 an hour minimum wage in Samoa compared to $31 in Australia for agriculture. We need to name and shame these dodgy people. I'll change a word there. I could almost guarantee these owners have been ripping off workers like this for many, many years, says Bo. Bo, thank you very much for your text message too. Keep them coming, 0467 842 722. In the meantime, though, let's talk harvest right now, with grain harvest flying along in Victoria this week thanks to favourable weather that's been hard to find earlier on this spring-summer period. Lee Burke is the co-owner of BB Harvesting at Donald, running a fleet of 24 harvesters, and Angus Verley spoke to him about their northern run of work and now that they're getting closer to Victoria.
Yeah, we had a good run up north. We're all out of there now, and thankfully we got finished before the rain all started, which generally happens up there. It gets a bit stormy the later it goes in the season, but we've got all machines back in Victoria now.
Rightio. So I know I've spoken to a few contractors who said they wrapped up a lot earlier than they thought in the north, and they had a bit of a period there where they were really scratching for work before things had really kicked off down here.
Yeah, it was like that. We just had a bit of a dream run up there, whereas it didn't get held up by much at all, and the jobs did get wrapped up. But for us, it probably worked out pretty well because we had a lot of machines to bring back down south, so it gave us plenty of time to transition to get all the machines back in the places where they needed to be on time.
And as it stands right now, Lee, we've had a few interruptions in Victoria with a few days off for rain and a total fire ban. Are you in full swing now?
Yeah, we are. We're right on top of things. We've got a couple of big farms that will finish up later this week. So it looks like the weather's going to be pretty right till Saturday. So we should, yeah, finish two or three jobs just locally around the Donald area, which will be good.
And from there, have you got more work booked up further down into the Western District?
Yeah, we've got a job down near Lake Bolac, but we'll have probably seven or eight machines sort of finishing up work at the end of this week, which we'll just head down that way and see what we can find.
So you'll be chasing more work to fill out the season?
Yeah, we will be. We definitely will be. We'll have plenty of machines available in the next week or so. So we'll try and keep them busy as long as we can till, you know, end of January. It looks like it's going to be a thumping season down the Western District. And if, you know, the Wimmera has obviously had some pretty good yields too. So I suppose people this year, and it has happened a few times now where people are seeing a weather event happen and the phones start ringing. So even though yields haven't been huge, I think the farmers have realised that what's out there, they want to get off before they get any downgrades, especially in barley when there has been some pretty good malt barley around. So,
Yeah, because it's getting on in the season now. We're not far from Christmas. In past years, a lot of Victoria, the harvest has been pretty well on top of by now, but still a fair bit to go in Vic.
Yeah, I think it was that later start. Like, we were coming in pretty hot there for a while when a lot of farmers probably decided to cut a lot of wheat for hay just to make sure they had something in the bank. And then the weather just cooled off. There was some rain events came and things just took forever to come in. So we had basically a pretty soft finish, you'd call it, in the end, and it sort of probably delayed us an extra 2 weeks than what we had first thought.
Something I've really noticed this year, and it's been creeping in for a couple of years, but when you talk about your crews of, you know, five or six headers in the one team, I was over in the Boort district a couple of weeks ago, and just amazing the amount of road trains getting around now, and I suppose that's just the sort of equipment you need to keep the grain away from these machines.
For sure. The tonnes an hour is only getting higher and higher, and what's helping now is that they can run the road train, so they can be carting their probably, you know, 65-tonne payload and that sort of stuff, which keeps the grain away, which only benefits us. There is a lot of farms now doing a lot of on-farm storage, which is good too, because if a weather event or any other things come in, they do shut up shop in town pretty quick. And if you can get that extra couple of hours by running your own storage, definitely does help as well.
And is it a balancing act where you want to have a deal of harvest capacity, I suppose, with late model machines, but you don't want to be outstripping your trucking capacity and having to park up machines waiting for trucks?
For sure, and that's where you've got to work closely with your client to make sure the logistics all works in with what tonnes an hour you think you can achieve. So you just got to keep, try and work a couple of days in front. So you don't want to have trucks sitting around, but then you don't want to have headers sitting around. So it's a bit of a compromise. You've got to try and make sure that you get it right and have backup, I suppose, if things don't go right. If there is some breakdown or this or that, you know, you might have a bag loader there that you can fire up to keep things moving.
That's Lee Burke, co-owner of BB Harvesting at Donald, speaking there with Angus Verley. It has been a big week, nearly 500,000 tonnes brought in Victoria, which was over a third of what had been brought in to GrainCorp silos already. And near the figures from GrainCorp, clearly more is being brought in elsewhere. An amazing stat coming out of WA too, which was incredible. CBH reported it twice smashed its daily receival records as part of a three-day streak. Took nearly close to the entire average wheat production of Ireland in a single day, taking in 3.9 million tonnes. I love stats like that come out of the paper. That came out of Farm Online. The entire average wheat production of Ireland being brought in every day in WA right now as things heat up with harvest over there. You're listening to The Country Hour. We've spent a lot of time over the last week in particular talking about our birthday. We celebrated 80 years. Well, one land management group in between Shepparton and Violettown, that made a pretty major milestone as well. Sheep Pen Creek Landcare hit 40 years this year. The group started out looking at problems like dry land salinity, soil erosion, and restoring native vegetation. And it's gone from there, as Annie Brown reports.
There's around 30 people shuffling around the inside of Kaniambo Public Hall looking for seats. We're about 27 kilometres southeast of Shepparton in a quiet farming district. Mounted on the walls of the hall, there's an honour roll of names of the local men who served in World Wars and a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. Adding to the history today, we're celebrating the last 40 years of the Sheep Pen Creek Land Management Group.
So before we start officially, just for full disclosure, this celebration is followed straight away by an AGM.
Nobody's led.
It wasn't a trap, but should you like to stay?
Colin Rankin was there from the beginning.
Well, we'd only hadn't long been in the district. We moved here from Strathmerton. I was previously a dairy farmer and wanted to be a sheep farmer. We quickly got sort of involved in the issues in the area related to soil degradation. And as I said before, salinity was the main talking point. Everybody was worried about how bad it was going to get and what we should do about it. We were approached, myself and a few others were approached by some department staff with the view to resurrecting an already existing land management group, which apparently had been around for quite a few years, but was in abeyance. And so we got together and formed a committee, and then shortly after that, along came Landcare. So we thought, well, we're on board with that. We'll become a Landcare group. And we had a big party up on the hill and planted a heap of trees, and a local primary school were involved, and everybody had a great time. And the early days were, you know, everybody was pretty fired up and willing to do their bit. You know, the erosion and things like that are still about, but the salinity is, you know, not really an issue anymore. It's still there. There are areas that are what we call salt scalds, which don't grow much of anything. But in some places, some of the land that's, you know, been managed well, it's actually returned now to quite productive soil, which I find amazing.
The group has always been a combination of farming and ecology. Doug Robinson first came to the region to do research for his PhD.
My involvement goes back to the early 1990s when I was working for what is now BirdLife Australia, and we began a project on an endangered bird called the grey-crowned babbler. And at the time, Sheep and Creek Land Management Group was the last known stronghold of the bird in Victoria. So I began doing field work up here. And then after 1 year, we moved up here, and I've been here ever since. So the group was always really supportive of the project, and very early on, landholders were giving me access to their properties to do surveys for the babblers, and then the group was supportive of a grant under the first Natural Heritage Trust funding round that came out in the mid-1990s to begin supporting sort of planting of trees and fencing off the little patches of bush on farmers' properties to help the bird. And I've been on the committee ever since.
And 40 years this year, officially, unofficially, could be 50. We were talking about it as well for Sheep Pen Creek Land Care Management Group. I guess when you reflect on that, you know, what do you think of most? Like, what are some of the best achievements of this group, would you say?
Bruce and one of our sort of long-term members, Jackie Campbell, talked about it really well at today's celebration. The group has had waves of action on different threats. So it began really with the soil erosion issues. It moved to the dryland salinity issue, then probably to improve pasture management. And then I've been part of a wave, obviously, that's been more interested in restoring native vegetation and bringing back more bush. We're about to change the chairman of the committee, I hope, shortly, tonight, at our AGM. And that will bring back, you know, one of the large farming families in the district to sort of set the new direction for the group.
After the celebration, the group had their annual general meeting and a new chair was appointed. Don Piper, a mixed sheep and cropping farmer from Earlston, who hopes to increase membership.
Yeah, Mum was heavily involved, you know, at the foundation stage as well, and we've got countless trees and tree guards at home that are, you know, all well established now. Well, literally from sort of, you know, 40 years ago. I'm 42 or 3, I think, now. And
age as the group.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, yeah, exactly. I can remember some of my earliest memories of Buddy out there ripping and planting trees and watering trees in the middle of summer that have been planted everywhere. So, yeah.
Tell me a bit about what your new role in this group is going to be and what you hope to do.
Just sort of trying to bring back probably more of a farmer focus, bring back some more local farmers in again, because as has happened in a few land care groups, what can tend to happen, you know, the farmers can get a little bit, you know, unsatisfied with the way it's sort of going. So we're really trying to, as I say, focus on that soil health aspect again, which really relates to farmers. Again, it doesn't matter, you know, what you're doing, because if your soil health's good, everything sort of benefits. So we're really, really going to push that side of things and just, yeah, try and broaden the member base again, and not necessarily a younger crowd, but just another generation, just to try and, you know, hopefully so it's going to be here another 40 years.
That's Don Piper, new chair of the Sheep Pen Creek Land Management Group, speaking with Annie Brown. Happy birthday to those guys. Look, Landcare's got a big birthday, I think, next year as well. But Landcare has a couple of birthdays because it started in Victoria and then went national. That's a whole thing in itself. But I'm always here for a birthday party.
$60, $50, $60,
$60.
Thank you.
Who you got?
I think I'm well and truly established. I'm here for a birthday party last week with a country house birthday. Let's go to livestock markets to see how they're selling as we get closer and closer to Christmas. Brendan Fletcher's at Bairnsdale. He can tell you how cattle are going. Take it away, Fletch.
G'day. Warwick numbers decreased to 300. That's 50 fewer, with the usual buyers operating in a cheaper market. Quality was limited, with prime cattle in short supply and cows representing over half of the sale. The handful of young cattle were cheaper in places with buyers more selective. Grown lots slipped 15 to 30 cents. Cows gave back 10 to 30 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 714 to 793 cents a kilogram carcass weight. A new buyer operating on the bulls didn't stop them from losing 15 to 45 cents. Yearling heifers suited to the trade sold from 410 to 430, grown steers and bullocks 420 to 448, manufacturing steers 360 to 430. Most light and medium weight cows 300 to 366, heavyweights 336 to 418, heavy bulls 378 to 458. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. Let's go to Hamilton Sheep and Lambs. Chris Agnew's there. Take it away, Chris.
Thanks, Warwick. At Hamilton Agent Yard, 55,000 lambs, where the quality of the new season's lambs was excellent, with lambs displaying maturity, weight, shape and freshness throughout most of the offering, with not as many lightweight lambs showing dryness. All of the regular buying group were present and most were active in a fully firm to slightly dearer market compared to Monday. New season's lambs to the trade to average in the range between 1,060 and 1,150 cents a kilogram carcass weight, so far topping at $405 per head. It was very good feeder and restocker competition on the lighter weight new season's lambs, generally making between 143 to 248. They picked up $20 to $30 per head on Monday's offering. New season's light lambs 12 to 16 kilos, making from 143 to 168. The heavier export lambs from 304 to a top of $405. This is an interim report as the sale is still in progress at Hamilton. This is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Good luck with the rest of it, Chris. Thank you very much for that. Graham Palmer is over at Horsham. We can get the market from there. Good afternoon, Graham.
Good afternoon, everyone. Both lamb and sheep supplies for the last sale of 2025, with 4,550 lambs and 1,350 sheep penned. Quality was mixed as harvest finally gets underway. Most of the usual buying group operating in a generally firm market, heavy lamb supply limited. Large percentage of the lambs suiting feeder and restocker orders. Medium and heavy trade weight lambs sold from 230 to 280, heavier weights to $280. The shorn lamb sold from 314 to 322. The shorn trade weight young lambs sold from 185 to 280. Merino lamb sold from 174 to 212. Restockers and feeders paid from 184 to 228 and from 162 to 236 for shorn young lambs. Sheep sold the setting demand, easing a few dollars in places. Heavy merino ewes made to 250, merino weathers to 242. Heavy crossbred used to 272. It's been Graham Palmer at Horsham from LA.
Thanks very much for that, Graham. Just before we get going, we might have started something here. Well, Joe, actually, the dairy farmer, might have started something here with the Goulburn Murray Water website. Someone says the GM Water website's a shocker. First screen day, it wants a username, so you type in your name, but it actually wants the user number, not the name. Nothing works. You ring them, and they say they're aware of it and will fix it. 4 weeks down the track, not fixed. I asked, why do this in the middle of the irrigation season? No answer. So there might be something worth following up there. I might put in a request on your behalf and see if we can find out some more details, although along those lines, Chris says, I wonder if the GMW new website cost $100 million. Yep, we could be going into another Bureau of Meteorology here. We'll have to wait and see. We can ask the questions on your behalf. Ash isn't happy with the CFA's new website. Maybe we needed a day to air the grievances of websites out there. Thank you very much for all bringing them in. And look, I did get a giggle about this text coming in earlier as well. Let me just try and find it. There we go. Warwick, you might get a giggle out of this. About how many, I wonder how many allegedly retired old blokes get this phone call at this time of year. G'day, what are you doing? Why? Well, the headers are going and I need a bin driver or a truck driver. When? Now, if you can. All right. Okay, then just come down to dot, dot, dot. Goes on from there. Thank you very much for sending that through. Hey, I'll be missing from the country out tomorrow. Well, actually, I'll be in the studio. I'll just be pushing the buttons. Faith Tabalion's going to be broadcasting for you from Warragul. I hope to get there. Couldn't get a car. But Faith will be there with you in Warragul in West Gippsland. Really interesting chat about farming in an area we don't always get to. So tune into the Country Hour tomorrow from that. We love being out and about and on the road. Don't think we've been in Warragul for a little while lately, so you'll have to tune in, check that out. And if you miss me when you listen tomorrow, listen to that show afterwards. Download the Victorian Country Hour podcast and tune in that way. Wherever you get your podcasts, Victorian Country Hour is what you search. You can have a look at those shows and listen back to old ones while you're there. I'll catch you later. It's 1 o'clock now.